From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Nurses learn a code of ethics in school. How is that code put to the test in the real world? We asked Dr. Cinda Hilton Rushton, a professor of clinical ethics at Johns Hopkins University, and Laurie Badzik, a nurse attorney and director of the American Nurses Association Center for Ethics and Human Rights. Then, a group in Baltimore wants to create the world's largest art park for graffiti artists, other artists, and skateboarders underneath the Jones Falls Expressway. We talk with Richard Best, the man behind the ambitious idea. Plus, Vienna is coming to Baltimore. Theater critic Jaywin Russick brings us her review of Baltimore Shakespeare Factory's Measure for Measure. And Tom Hall talks with Baltimore writer Dan Vesperman about his new novel, Unmanned. It deals with the secretive world of drone warfare. First news.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WIPR.org. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Respect for human dignity, protecting patients' health, advocating for patients' rights. These are just a few of the provisions in the nurse's code of ethics. How does that code of ethics play out in the real world? What happens when a nurse's ethics are challenged, and what structures are in place to help nurses care for patients in the ways they know they're supposed to? Those questions will be taken up at a three-day nursing ethics summit that starts day after tomorrow at the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. With me in the studio to talk about some of these issues is Dr. Cinda Hilton Rushton, professor of clinical ethics at Johns Hopkins University School of Nursing. She's the organizer of the ethics summit. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Sheila.
And on the line from her home in West Virginia is Laurie Badzik, a nurse attorney and a professor of nursing at West Virginia University. Laura Badzik, welcome.
Thank you.
Professor Badzik, I just mentioned a few provisions in the Nurses' Code of Ethics. What are the two or three that are most applicable, that show up most in a nurse's daily responsibilities?
I think the first three provisions are probably the ones that show up most often in a nurse's practice, and those provisions actually deal sort of with nurse-to-patient interactions.
So most of us aren't that familiar with the Nurses' Code of Ethics, so what are those first three?
Well, the first provision talks about the nurse practicing with compassion and respect, thinking about the inherent dignity, worth, and uniqueness of each person. The second provision talks about the nurse's primary commitment being to the patient, whether that patient's an individual, a family, or a group. And the third provision is the provision that states that the nurse will promote and advocate and protect the health and safety and the rights of the patient.
Dr. Rushton, the media announcement of this Nursing Ethics Summit refers to, quote, the ethical issues that keep nurses up at night, close quote. Give me an example.
There are so many examples of things that keep nurses up at night, ranging from conflicts between what patients want, perhaps what their family wants, and perhaps even what the medical team wants. So an example would be a patient we cared for not long ago who had cancer and had many rounds of chemotherapy and then had a relapse, had another recurrence. And she was faced with a question of, should I pursue more treatment or should I sort of let this disease progress? Well, she had her own views about that, and her children, who she was very sensitive to their concerns, felt she ought to press on, and she wasn't so sure about that. But in the end, she decided to go forward, and she pursued more chemotherapy, and then she had a very serious blood infection. She was admitted to the intensive care unit and didn't have the capacity any longer to speak for herself. Her children disagreed about whether they should press on or not. There was disagreement between the oncologist and the ICU doctor. And the nurse was in the middle of that, trying to understand the perspectives of each of those parties and also trying to figure out, how do I honor this woman? How do we provide ethical care for her in the middle of this kind of conflict? These are everyday occurrences.
Everyday occurrences. Laura Badzik, does a nurse who's
in a hospital or in a private practice have time to think about ethics?
I think they think about ethics a lot. I don't know that they actually resolve dilemmas in a hurry, and we hope that they actually think through them. But certainly they're challenged to think about ethics because of the different things, examples like Cinda has given you, as well as other issues that impact their practice. The fatigue of nurses coming into work in situations where there aren't enough nurses. Certainly, you know, they need to, you know, they do think about that because they're faced with it. And then there are other issues such as the, you know, the new electronic health records and social media. So all of these things are impinging upon their practice. So I think they are faced with the issues, so they do think about it. And, you know, they, you know, hopefully, you know, use their code of ethics
Dr. Rushton,
to make decisions around those ethical issues.
Dr. Rushton, the at the summit this week, the Nursing Ethics Summit, how is that going to touch on what we've been talking about?
So the premise of the Nursing Ethics Summit is that nurses are confronted with these issues every day, and that it's an important time. The urgency in our healthcare system for change really requires us to pause and reset our ethical compass and to reflect on how, as a profession, we are going to uphold these important values. So we are, for the first time ever, bringing together a group of nurse ethicists, representatives from our strategic partners, nursing organizations, including the American Nurses Association and nine others, to create a roadmap for 21st century nursing. What is it? What are the qualities and competencies that nurses need to practice ethically now and in the future? How does that translate into clinical practice, into education? And what are the policies and structures that are needed to help nurses practice ethically? And how can we create an evidence base through research to support them to do the right thing in the right way for the right reason?
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Dr. Cinda Hilton Rushton, nursing professor at Johns Hopkins School of Nursing, and with Laurie Badzik, West Virginia University nurse attorney. We're talking about ethical issues that nurses face. Professor Badzik, you direct the American Nurses Association Center for Ethics and Human Rights, and I understand that it's working on an update of the Code of Ethics. Are there gaps? Are there holes in it?
For the most part, the Code of Ethics is in good shape. It's a 2001 Code of Ethics that we are revising, but there are some gaps. You know, healthcare and nursing and medicine are constantly changing. And so, for example, things that were not included in the 2001 Code that have come about are social media and genomics. These are words that, you know, we didn't really use back in the late 90s when we revised that code. And so the new terminology is being inserted into the Code of Ethics in the places that are most helpful to nurses. The other thing that the code does is it, as we revise the code, we're able to clarify areas of the code where the nurses are seeking more information or more help. So, for example, areas like conscientious objection and areas of the code that relate to the nursing's perspective and commitment to the broader society and to global health, which again is an issue that's been around but hasn't really been clarified, are in the new revised code that will come out in 2015.
Does the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, raise any new issues? You mentioned social media and electronic medical records as sort of new frontiers.
Certainly it does. And the Affordable Health Care Act and, you know, the IOM Future of Nursing Report have changed nursing's perspective and made it even more important for nurses to be leaders in ethical, you know, care so that we can assure that patients get, you know, safe, quality, effective care. And so it does play into it in the sense that, you know, as a whole, overall, the code, you know, is written now more for all nurses in leadership positions as well as at the bedside, those in education and those in research. And so, you know, we continue to clarify that the code is for all groups and that all nurses must work together, which is what's so wonderful and so important about the summit, that we're bringing all of these perspectives together to look at, you know, what are the needs of the future nurse.
Dr. Rushton, what do nursing students learn about ethics in school?
Well, it's quite variable, and that's one of the areas that we're going to focus on. In our own program here at Johns Hopkins, we have just gone through a curriculum revision and making the foundation of ethics much more explicit. In the graduate program, I teach a core course for all of our graduate nursing students that really focuses on giving them the knowledge, the skills, the competence to be able to recognize and respond to ethical issues, to have a process of analyzing what the different points of view are and how we balance these different perspectives. But really importantly, how do we help nurses have the confidence to speak up and speak out once they've recognized that there's a threat to an important ethical principle? How do they work and communicate effectively with patients and families, with their interprofessional colleagues, and with administrators to come to decisions that we can all live with? And clearly, ethical issues often, we find there's not any easy answers. And for that reason, we have to learn how to deal with uncertainty.
We're down to just a minute or so. Dr. Badzik, what do nurses need to make this work? Can you give me a sort of a short idea to hang on to?
I think that they need exactly what Cinda was saying. They need a mechanism to use as their own process of ethical decision-making to determine what conflicts exist and whether or not they can resolve that conflict on their own. And if they cannot resolve it, then they need to go to the other mechanisms, to their leadership, to their ethics committees, to their colleagues, so that they can deal with these ethical issues. Because what we know is that nurses who are able and have more knowledge about ethics and can move through a process of ethical decision-making experience less distress in their workplace.
Thank you both for talking to us about it. And I hope the summit produces something great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Cinda Hilton-Rushton is the Anne and George Bunting Professor of Clinical Ethics at Johns Hopkins University and organizer of this week's Nursing Ethics Summit. Laura Badzik, who grew up in Baltimore, is a nurse attorney and professor of nursing at West Virginia University. The Nursing Ethics Summit is invitation only, but there are ways the nursing community can be involved. You can follow the discussions on Twitter using the hashtag NursingEthics. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast ahead on Maryland Morning, constructing an art park under the JFX. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. Go to our website to learn more about a segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. If you spend any time in Baltimore's Station North Arts and Entertainment District, you've probably peeked into Graffiti Alley. As the name implies, graffiti blankets every inch of a cramped little alley off Howard Street near North Avenue. What if you gave all that graffiti a little room to breathe, say 3.5 acres worth of room? A group in Baltimore wants to build the world's largest urban art park at 3.5 acres, a stone's throw from Graffiti Alley, underneath the Jones Falls Expressway. It's the brainchild of Richard Best, and he joins me now to talk about it. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Sheila.
Paint us a picture of what is there now and what you are trying to make of this 3.5 acres.
Well, like you said, the site is currently, it's like 3.5 acre space. It's located directly behind Mica underneath, you know, JFX. It's been abandoned for roughly 30 years. So it's just been a dumping ground, really. There's like trash and unused construction equipment. There's piles of bricks, piles of cat foods and cat food cans and some feral cats. So it's just a really blighted, vacant, derelict space. And we, like you said, we want to transform that into what will be the world's largest urban art park and a cultural and creative hub for the city of Baltimore.
And what would that look like, that art park?
So current plans for the site include roughly 60,000 square feet of murals, two live performance spaces, a skateboard park, as well as roughly an acre of lush green space.
Where did you get? Where did this idea start to form?
So the project was, it started as an independent thesis project while I was in grad school. So it was just graduated from a dual master's program between Johns Hopkins and MICA called Design Leadership. And in the program, we really like to study sustainability and social value creation. And in addition to that, I'm also a street artist. I paint murals. And I got a call from a friend who's a local artist that was painting in the space, and he had me come down to it and gave me like this treasure map. And he was like, go behind Micah and duck down behind these cameras and then hop down on the railroad tracks and go through these tunnels. And I finally came up to the site, and it was dark. And I came to the site, and it's just massive. I completely lost my sense of direction and started just wandering through it. And it was endless. It just kept going and kept going and kept going. And so, just like all these tools that I was learning in grad school kind of just clicked in. And so, I just kind of like asked myself, I'm like, what could this space be? What could we do with this space? I mean, we know it. We know artists are coming down here and they're using it.
Because there is graffiti there
now. Yeah, there's tons of graffiti there. So there's tons of graffiti there. But at the same time, these artists they're not allowed to use the space. And so I think it's like really interesting that, individuals have found value in an abandoned space, yet at the same time they can be persecuted for doing so. So then just kind of ask ourselves, what could this space be? And it sits directly behind Micah, directly next to Station North. So there's this vibrant, rich artist community around it. So the question is, what happens if we just open this up to this creative community? And what would that park look like then? And what would it need to be designed to facilitate? And so over the course of a year, kind of designed it into, sculpted our proposal into what we have now.
Right now, Graffiti Alley is the only space in Baltimore where graffiti artists are
correct.
Welcome.
Yeah, it's the only legally sanctioned space for artists to paint. And because, like you said, it's so small, the work doesn't stay up that long, and it kind of deters a lot of artists from going in and painting there because their pieces aren't going to be up that long. So we're going to have a much bigger space, like 60,000 square feet of space, so artists can come down and paint. And some of that space will be open wall, so artists, anybody, not just graffiti artists, but open up that space to a whole new, generation of artists to perform, public art.
That's Richard Best here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Best is heading a project that would create the largest urban art park in the world under the Jones Falls Expressway in Baltimore. Did projects in other cities shape what you think you can do here?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of precedent that we pulled from. You can look at Wynwood Walls in Miami, which is an outdoor street art museum, and it was developed by a real estate developer named Tony Goldman, and he used urban art really to come in and revitalize and rejuvenate urban spaces.
This sounds like it could be an expensive project.
It could be, yeah.
Like how much?
Well, we don't exactly know the exact numbers right now, and we don't know that for several reasons. One, we're currently doing our environmental studies to see what kind of environmental remediation needs to happen. And at the same time, we, yes, have a vision for the park, but really the development and the design of the space is going to be an inclusive process. So we're going to bring in the community. We're going to again bring in skateboarders. We're going to bring in musicians. We're going to bring in artists. We're going to bring in the community and ask them what they want in the space. And so the vision is going to mold and adapt based off of what the community wants. And until we really have identified exactly what that's going to be, the cost isn't going to, we don't necessarily have those exact numbers.
Environmental remediation of what? What's
the ground. And this is a problem all over Baltimore. They use contaminated topsoil just to fill in dirt. And so all over Baltimore is contaminated with, various different elements. So we don't yet know if there needs to be environmental remediation. So we're doing those studies right now.
Have you raised any money?
Yeah, we raised some money. We were awarded a lab award from MICA. So it was an award. They give out $5,000-$10,000 awards every year to try to fund projects which try to keep the creative community within Baltimore. So we won that. We we officially launched our community outreach to tell the public about the park during Artscape, and we had the community come out. We had some bricks donated from an organization called Details. So we repurposed these bricks by having a small donation. It was roughly $5, and the community would then be able to paint these bricks, and we'll use them in the construction of the park. So everyone can really have their own ownership of it and have their own piece of art in, you know, the world's largest urban art park. And it was extremely successful, and we raised another $10,000 there. But we currently are in the process of officially setting up the 501c3. So as soon as that's done, which really probably less than a couple weeks, then we can actually start kicking off our real fundraising efforts.
So you talked earlier about the renegade artists who are using this space now. I mean, do you expect people who are doing street art illegally to come into the open and do it here?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Artists really want to be artists, and whether that's graffiti is your form of art or other forms of street art, yeah, I mean, they want to have space. They need to have space to create their work. And, we already have relationships with a lot of these artists, and they're all of them are so excited to be able to have a space where they can go and paint, and they're not going to have to worry about, you know, getting arrested.
So they won't miss being outlaws?
Maybe. Maybe we should ask some of them. I think, you know, we might change a little. We're definitely going to change the culture of the space down there. So it's not going to be a graffiti park. It is. I mean, once the space is open, nothing that's down there is graffiti because it's all legal. It's all welcomed. But it has a potential to kind of to change that conversation of what urban art is, what street art is, because we're opening up this medium to anybody who really wants to practice it. And we get emails every day. People are like, hey, I've always wanted to paint a mural, but I've never been able to.
Well, I appreciate you telling us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard Best. He heads the Section 1 project, a group that wants to create the largest urban art park in the world under the Jones Falls Expressway. We've got links to more about the project, including a link to an impressive slideshow of the space that the Baltimore Business Journal recently created. That's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, we take the measure of Shakespeare's Measure for Measure. Stay with us on 88.1.
Producer Jamila Kay. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Maryland Morning theater critic J. Wynn Russick has been to see Measure for Measure, presented by the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory. She brings us this review.
Theater companies have produced plays outdoors at the Evergreen Museum and Library for years. But the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory's Measure for Measure is being staged in a rather novel spot. Instead of the usual meadow setting in back, director Tom DeLise has mounted the play immediately in front of Evergreen House. The house becomes a stand-in for the palace of the Duke of Vienna, the character who sets this dark, disturbing problem play in motion. Morals, it seems, have been slipping in Vienna, and not wanting to play the heavy himself, the Duke appoints a straight arrow named Angelo to be his enforcer. Angelo decides to make an example of a man named Claudio, who has impregnated his fiancée. Of course, among modern American royalty, that is to say, celebrities, baby bumps before marriage seem to be all the rage. Not so in Angelo's erstwhile puritanical regime. Angelo sentences Claudio to death. Claudio's sister Isabella pleads for leniency and, in the process, turns the head of self-righteous, hypocritical Angelo. Oh, yes, and the Duke observes it all while disguised as an understanding but meddling friar. As an actor explains before this production begins, Shakespeare used the music of his day, and the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory uses the music of our day. The company makes another semi-bow to Shakespeare's era when all the female parts were played by men. The Shakespeare Factory also does cross-gender casting, although in this production several male roles, including the Duke and a pimp, are played by women. The results vary. A number of cast members overdo their performances, infusing them with heavy doses of anger and pumping up their gestures and volume. Valerie Dowdle is more restrained as the Duke turned friar. By the time the Duke learns of the immoral deal that Angelo offers Isabella, Dowdle has left room for the Duke's indignation to build and to be slightly bemused by the discovery of Angelo's duplicity.
Twice treble shame on Angelo to weed my vice and let his grow. Oh, what may man within him hide, though angel on the outward side?
Joel Ottenmeyer displays the most range as Isabel's condemned brother Claudio. His sudden reversal of opinion about saving his sister's honor is one of the rare times we see a character change. As smug Angelo, Alex Smith is dressed in black with a military haircut and ramrod posture. But Smith sells this Machiavellian upholder of morality short by hyping his rancor. Even Angelo's attraction to Isabella sounds angry.
Plainly conceive, I love you.
My brother did love Juliet, and you tell me that he shall die for it.
He shall not, Isabel, if you give me love.
I will proclaim thee, Angelo. Look for it. Sign me a present pardon for my brother, or with an outstretched throat I'll tell the world aloud what man thou art.
Who will believe thee, Isabel?
Granted, Angelo could be angry at himself for being attracted to Isabella. But this notion would be more effective with more shadings leading up to it. Angelo is one of two male characters attracted to Isabella in the course of the play. But Aaron Wagner's relatively flat, caught-in-the-headlights portrayal makes it difficult to appreciate the source of that attraction. In addition, the sameness of Tom DeLise's direction takes much of the tension out of Shakespeare's troubling play. The director repeatedly positions actors at the corners of his square stage, or has one circle the perimeter while another pivots in the center. There's still a lot of relevance in Measure for Measure. Who can't name one or several 21st century politicians hoisted on their own holier-than-thou petards? It doesn't take updating to make you think about these resonances. But the Baltimore Shakespeare Factory's production left me thinking primarily about yelling and anger. Would that this Measure for Measure were a little more measured.
Maryland Morning Theater critic J. Wynn Russick. Baltimore Shakespeare Factory's production of Measure for Measure is up at the Evergreen Museum and Library through next Sunday, August 17. There are additional performances later in August at two other locations. You can find them on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Dan Fesperman is an award-winning novelist and former foreign correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. He's got a new novel, which he'll launch tomorrow night at the Ivy Bookshop in Baltimore. It's called Unmanned, and it leads readers into the scary and intriguing realm of drones. And guess what? They're not just for war anymore. Dan Fesperman joins me in the studio. Hey, Dan, how you doing?
Hi.
It's good to see you. So this is your ninth book.
Yes, it is.
Since you left reporting for The Sun and others. Why drones? Why this particular topic at this particular time?
I got fascinated with the whole idea of what it would be like to be one of these pilots. I almost want to say poor pilots, because some of them feel that way initially. They're flying these hot jets all over the world. They've got the most wonderful job in the Air Force. And then they get pulled out and stuck in some trailer out in the desert, and told that for the next 8 hours every workday they're going to be piloting these things thousands of miles away. They can be very tedious jobs. They're very important jobs, so it's a lot of pressure and stress. But it's just a strange, bizarre world where you have this intimacy with the area you're looking at, even though you have this incredible detachment literally 9 hours away in the time zone, sometimes there in the into the future, and you're seated just so far away from it all. It's one of the most bizarre jobs I've ever heard of, and yeah. I just had to look into that.
And you spend a lot of time blowing things up and supporting ground troops. I mean,
right.
particularly the drone strikes that have been, you know, we've been reading and hearing so much about in yeah. Afghanistan and Pakistan. And then you go home and there you are. You're living in Nevada somewhere. And you've got
yeah.
a suburban, you know, lifestyle outside of that.
Right. You yeah. go home to your kid's Little League game or whatever, and you can't talk at all about your job. So if it was a particularly tough day, that's too bad.
The main protagonist in the book, a guy named Darwin Cole, has one of those particularly tough days.
Yeah.
And it leads to him becoming kind of down on his luck after a while.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Darwin Cole. He ends up working with three reporters trying to sort of untangle what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
But he's an interesting character. Introduce him to us.
He was at the top of the food chain in the Air Force. He was flying F-16s out of a base in Italy, and his commanding officer called him aside one day, and with a little speech laced with profanities, he told him that he was getting a bum deal and that he was being transferred to this Xbox program, as they called it to each other in those days. And he tries to keep his chin up. He sees the value of these things, but things go terribly wrong in a mission of his when, due to bad intelligence, lots of civilians are killed. He unfortunately, right before the missile hits, sees some children running from the house. And it haunts him. He was already kind of out there from the tension and the stress of this job. There is a high burnout rate with these jobs, like 25-30%. And he can't handle that. And he ends up a year later after doing some things he should not and being dishonorably discharged in a court-martial. And he ends up out in a trailer, drunk. His family's moved away. He's on his own. And some journalists approach him and say, we think we'd like to get to the bottom of this probably as much as you would, because we think the fellow who screwed this up is someone we're interested in as well. And he takes the bait.
And your book is in a lot of ways a critique of the people in your former profession and the profession that your wife now holds,
yes.
Liz Bowie, the education reporter for This Sun.
Right.
And there are interesting analogies that you draw between spies and
yes.
the sort of daring do types and reporters.
Yeah.
Having to do with, you know, who you trust, who you don't.
And how you get information and whether it's ethical or legal and all of that.
Yeah.
Kind of
Tell thing. Us a little bit about the reporters that Cole ends up hanging out with.
Well, there are three of them, and they're all out on their own, having all taken buyouts. Two from the Baltimore Sun, where I did work for a long time, and where, as you said, my wife still works. One from the Boston Globe, but she's from originally, her family at least, has a place on the eastern shore of Maryland. So they all end up working together because they were discovering each other's fingerprints on this same story they were all pursuing about this possible rogue CIA operative overseas who was the one who basically Darwin Cole was relying on for his intelligence on this mission.
In your real-life experience, is it common for journalists to band together for a freelance piece? This is not for any particular.
Yeah.
It's not for the Sun or the
right.
Globe. Or something. Is it common for two or three people to work together on the same piece?
It's not, and that's why they feel sort of uneasy with the whole arrangement. But they were discovering that each of them had separate threads of the same story. Their buyout money is running out. That's pretty common. And
yeah.
they have been unable to find other jobs in the profession. That was not that uncommon. But they want to continue as journalists, and that's tough. So they decided to join forces for economic reasons as much as anything, and because they figure with all of what they were gathering, they might even get a good book deal out of it if they stick together long enough. But that's the problem. How well can they work together? They were all kind of lone wolves. They didn't particularly work well with others or play well with others, and it's a bit of a challenge for them.
Dan Vesperman is my guest. His latest book deal is for a book called Unmanned. It's a terrific read on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. You take up the issues of the applications of this drone technology
yeah.
In the book, when it's used as a surveillance mechanism, when it's used as a weapon. And you also take up the issue of who controls its use. Is that
yeah.
in the hands of the military? Is it
mm-hmm.
in the hands of intelligence agencies
mm-hmm.
Or even commercial use? Does your novel take up a point of view about what should and shouldn't happen with these drones and this technology?
It doesn't, but I think it could probably help somebody shape their point of view because there is a lot of overlap. The CIA has its own drones, but it also will get priority on military missions when it wants something done or looked at in certain areas. Some of these privateers that are out there, they're very prevalent on the ground in places like Afghanistan and the tribal areas of Pakistan, and they have their own little units. Some of them have ex-CIA people, ex-special forces. They have their own assignments. Sometimes they're for the military. Sometimes it's not. It can get pretty confusing and pretty strange out there. And so all of this starts to overlap.
So there are private entities using drones for commercial purposes, but they not just in non-war zones but in war zones themselves.
Well, it's hard to say how much use they get out of the drones. They are not flying their own over there. But if they are working on a military mission for the United States Army – on the ground, then they would sometimes get drone support.
You write about the amazing things that these drones can accomplish and do, both in the commercial realm as well as the military realm. At one point, there's a small drone that you say in the book, at least, can copy the contents of a laptop computer and bring a thumb drive back to base. Is that real or is that imagined?
Now, these small drones are real. Their capabilities, that's pretty secret right now. Most of the capabilities that I write about are pretty well documented already. Some of them with the smaller drones, it's harder to say, but I would say that if anything, I've probably underestimated their capabilities.
Yeah, it's really quite fascinating. Are there a number of nefarious applications for these drones that we should be worried about in the commercial realm? Because, you know, you've got people like Jeff Bezos, you know, famously going on 60 Minutes a few months back saying, you know, pretty soon the drones are going to deliver the books to your doorstep.
I don't think it's nefarious that they would be delivering things, but it's airspace problems, sir. I think you're going to see the FAA probably saying no to a lot of these applications, at least until some of the earlier and other applications show that it can work all right, because they are not always the most reliable machines. You can lose control of them. I think in New York they had a recent case where some apartment complex had to ban their residents from flying their own drones from the front entrance because one had crashed on somebody's terrace. So these things are starting to proliferate out into the private world and hobbyists, and the capabilities are pretty amazing, especially with their cameras they can put on board.
Yeah, and you can only imagine that we're going to hear more and more stories like that.
That
this is really going to be a regulatory nightmare for somebody.
Yeah, and it already is, and the regulations are already coming out, and they're protesting the new regulations. They're saying, well, we're not going to allow you to fly them with these goggles where you can see it, sort of virtual reality goggles almost, except you're seeing what the drone is seeing from these goggles.
Your other novels, this is your ninth novel, as we mentioned. You've got them located in places like Guantanamo and Berlin and Dubai. This one takes place a little bit in Afghanistan, but much of it in Baltimore and then on the Eastern Shore. So this is a change of pace for you, kind of closer to home.
Yeah. It is. But it's an area I'm obviously comfortable with. Just I was comfortable in those other settings because I'd been there. But it was kind of fun to set some things closer to home for a change.
There are some great names in this book. I noticed the name Wally Orlinsky, one little character who isn't a main character, but
he's
mentioned. But of course, those of us who've been around Baltimore for a while know Mr. Orlinsky as the former city council president who left office under less than ideal conditions.
Yeah.
And then sort of resurrected his public image later in his life. Do you have any rule for how you create or steal names for people in your books?
I like the names to sort of fit what the character does. In this case, Wally Orlinsky does not have a speaking role in this book. He is mentioned in conjunction with another CIA agent who does. That was just kind of a throw-in for – I figured if I'm going to have some Maryland settings in here, maybe I'd have a little inside joke for old Baltimore readers who would see that name and go, oh, Wally Orlinsky, I remember him.
City Council President and secret agent.
A different guy, obviously, but it was just – it was a nice name. It's a great name, Wally Orlinsky, so put in there.
This one, like all the other ones, assiduously researched. What were your big challenges in finding out about the topic of drones?
It was hard to get time with the pilots. The Air Force seemed pretty reluctant. They do deal with authors, aside from just journalists who want to know about these things. But they kept putting me off month after month. And it took about 4 months for me to finally get some time out at this Air Force base outside of Las Vegas to talked to some of these guys. And it was invaluable because they talked about, they readily addressed what a bizarre job it was and how eerie it was even sometimes to feel like you would intimately know some little community you were looking at through your cameras very closely for maybe 4 or 5 hours, maybe 2 different days. And then to possibly have to make a decision after that to blow up one of the houses or something like that. So it was strange for them in the way that just being a jet pilot was not in that. You might fire a missile, not even see what you hit, and then fly away. And this, not only do you have to maybe destroy something you've become closely knowledgeable about, but you then have to assess the damage for 3-4 hours and look at that closely to see what you've wrought there. Yeah. So.
Well, it's a complex story. It's beautifully told. It's a page-turner. A lot of fun, like your other books. Really enjoyed it. So congratulations.
Thanks.
Thanks so much. Dan Fesperman, he'll talk about his new book, Unmanned, tomorrow night at the Ivy Bookshop. It's part of their Master of Intrigue series. The festivities begin at 7 o'clock. The Ivy Bookshop is up on Falls Road in North Baltimore. We've got a link to details on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us this morning. Coming up Wednesday, Sheila talks to the new CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools, Greg Thornton. And Matt Purdy, our intrepid producer, recounts his experience on the Soylent diet with the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. I hope you can join us Wednesday morning on Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is an original production of your public radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. For more about what you've heard on our show or to catch something you've missed, again, come to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. Brandon Block, Alexander Kennedy, and Justina Latimer give us production help. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.